Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. Once again, some markets hit record highs this week, likely pushed by lower interest rates. Ross takes a look at gold, silver, the U.S. and Canadian dollars, Bitcoin, and corn. InsideTrackTrading.com president Eric Haddock examines the cycles concerning the stock markets, interest rates, the U.S. and Canadian dollars, Bitcoin, gold, silver, petroleum products, agriculture, and even wars and violence. Robert Campbell from RealEstateTiming.com is here to chat about the state of real estate across the U.S. and especially in California. Prices are still going up for the most part, but not very fast. He talks about the possibility of the U.S. backing its currency with gold and whether the greenback is about to lose its reserve currency status. Robert also emphasizes the importance of both mental and physical health. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on X at Charts by Ross. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Always a pleasure, Jim.
Ross, how would you describe what happened on the stock markets this week?
Well, I mean, everybody was sitting with bated breath waiting for the Fed to drop interest rates. And, you know, when we had been taking a look at what had happened to T-bills for the last 4 months, as they had eased off, there was no question at all that the Fed, which is a follower, not a leader, as far as things like the Fed funds are concerned, they did the quarter point move, which was just right on track with what's been happening in T-bills. So no surprise at all to the equity markets. And so after maybe a few hours of a little hiccup, the major indices like the S&P and the Dow and the NASDAQ are pushing up into all-time highs again. So we had, minor oversold conditions August the 21st. Then you retested the lows at the turn of the month here, 1st of September. So those are the critical levels to be watching for. When we look at things on the credit side, the high-yield bonds, the CCCs and the HYGs, they are continuing to move higher, so that's a good solid move from that perspective. When you look at the global money supply M2, years ago we used to look at just the U.S. one, but if you keep a good track here on the international ones, then the whole global money supply has been growing, and when that happens, the money's looking for a place to go, and sometimes it's into industrial items and corporate buildups, but so much of that money these days is going into equities, and as long as that money supply grows like this, it's going to be supportive of the market. Let's see what happens during September, October, which can be a bit of a hiccup for the market. But at this point, anything back towards that holds that 1st of September low, I think you still have to look at it as a bull market. And for all that some of the longer-term cycles are getting a little bit long in the tooth, we've got to give this market full credit for what it's doing at this point.
What's going on with gold?
Gold market, we talked about 10 days ago, has some good upside signals in terms of exhaustions in silver and in gold. Had a very minor pause here, and then at the tail end of this week after the move on the Fed, we've seen some life come back into the sector. the mining stocks, the GDX, GDXJ, the SIL, SILJ, were into exhaustion mode on a daily and weekly basis here 10 days ago. They've had a pause. They're trying to make a move back towards the highs. So we'll see what happens there. It's been an excellent run, and clearly it's time to have some stops underneath just in case they run out of steam. And, we want to look at what's happening in the U.S. dollar. I mean, we still, on a simplistic basis, when the dollar's weak, commodities are strong on a relative basis. And if we look at U.S. dollar in this last week or so, it was down and made a multi-month low for one day, and then it has turned back pretty darn quickly in the second half of this week. What we need to watch for is that the support level that we had through the summer, that was broken. We call that the ice. And it has now come back to test that. So that would be at 97.70 on the dollar index. And if it pushes through there, that would be a pretty strong signal. And you could be looking for a decent run in the dollar. If that occurs, it's going to keep some headwind as far as the gold and silver are concerned. But for now, the dollar index, it's a really good bounce, and we'll keep an eye at that 97.70. When we take a look at the euro, the British pound, the yen, Canadian dollar, they've all topped in the last 3 or 4 days and starting to show some weakness. So on a reciprocal basis to what we're seeing in the dollar index, that looks reasonable. And, we'll see how much these things want to give up ground.
What's happening with crude?
Crude, we are quiet. Still looking for some seasonal weakness, ideally in October, November, December, and just hoping that we get it breaking enough to produce some decent buy signals. Historically, when we get the weekly charts overdone on the downside in this fourth quarter of the year, it provides some great opportunities for a rally into the first quarter. So you need patience at this point. And, I think you just sit back and wait for it to evolve.
What's going on with Bitcoin?
Bitcoin, nice bounce here, from, we were down to 108,000 and we've bounced back to 117. So that is, it's, shy of the highs that it put in, the all time highs. So we've now got a lower high in place and, getting some, short term overbought signals. So wouldn't be surprised that, Bitcoin goes back down and retests that 108 level or lower. I think for the traders in Bitcoin, you want to be on the sidelines right now or short, and look at that 117 to 118 as a pretty big overhead resistance.
Anything else we should be keeping a close eye on?
Yeah, we got great bottoming signals here in corn back in August. Put out some signals on that one, and we've had a nice rally, 10% move off the bottom, getting a little overbought right now, so probably has a pretty good pause. The other one that was really of interest in the summer was the uraniums. So on August, middle of August, August the 21st, we got good oversold signals there. These were oversold and rising trends, so that's the type of thing you want to get on board. And if you just look across the whole sector of stocks there, I think 80% of them are now up and testing all-time highs or at least multi-year highs. So that trend, even though some of the weekly charts on a couple of the stocks might look a little overdone, there's lots of potential as far as this sector is concerned. I think You just want to be there and enjoy the run. So, you know, there's some decent stuff going on out there right now, and it's nice to be able to participate.
Ross, thank you so much for the update.
Thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on X at Charts by Ross. Coming up, Eric Haddock next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Eric Haddock, CEO and president of InsideTrackTrading.com. He's speaking to us from Central California. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Oh, well, thanks for having me back, Jim.
Eric, what's new at InsideTrack, spelled with two I's, and how can our listeners subscribe?
Well, I'm not sure that there's too much new at InsideTrack, but your listeners can find out a wealth of information, including how to subscribe, what different publications we offer, what terms of subscriptions there are, all of that at our primary website of InsideTrackTrading.com. And like you mentioned, that's inside with the two I's. So it is INSIIDE, TrackTrading.com.
Well, U.S. stock markets have been putting in more all-time highs. We do know October's around the corner, a scary month traditionally when it comes to trading. Are the cycles showing any concerns for October?
Well, I could say that they're probably showing a little bit of concern, and I obviously have to steer it towards the price action, which really is the ultimate filter, the ultimate determining factor. But there are a couple of things coming into play in the next few trading days that could time an intermediate high in stocks. I know when we talked last, I was discussing how late July should see a multi-week high and then some consolidation. We got that, and the next cycle partially linked to that one, when we could see another multi-week cycle, is in late September. In fact, if you go back over the last, even just the last year of trading, you can see indexes like the Dow Industrials peaking on a very regular and somewhat geometric basis every 60 degrees or 60 days. You look at the highs that it set in late September of last year. Then late November was when many of the primary indexes peaked before their 30% and greater declines into April. Following that late November high, your next high was in late January, 2 months later. And then once the market started to decline, they rebounded into one final high in late March, just before the plunge into early April. But that two-month cycle continued to time intermediate highs, with a subsequent one in late May, then the one we were anticipating in late July. And it would perpetuate that cycle even more if we see one coming in next week, early next week, probably September 22nd, 23rd would be the ideal time. And when I use the term ideal, I just mean the time with the greatest synergy of cycles and timing indicators that I follow. But there's even a related and corroborating one-month cycle that has followed my cycle progression rules very accurately. And if you just look at the time between the 21st and the 23rd of the month, and you go back to April, you saw your secondary low on April 21st, then a subsequent low on May 23rd, then a subsequent low on June 23rd. And based on a couple of indicators, that was when I expected this cycle progression to invert, which is part of its structure. And so you saw a an entire one-month rally into that late July cycle where it topped on July 23rd, and then we saw the subsequent high on August 22nd. So you've had this pretty precise cycle progression unfold on the 21st to the 23rd of the month, has followed the rules that I use for that, and it is also portending at least a 1 to 2 week high, maybe something a little higher magnitude than that on September 21st to the 23rd. And since the 21st is not a trading day, you're looking at the 22nd and 23rd again. So you've got some things coming together early next week. It will be critical to see where the remaining days of this week trade, and where we close today and tomorrow, where the week closes. And that should corroborate this outlook. And from there, we do see a kind of a vulnerable period between September 23rd and early October, a couple specific days in early October, when the market could suffer a little bit of a sell-off in there.
This week, the Fed cut rates by a quarter point. The Bank of Canada dropped its rate by a quarter percent. What are the interest rate cycles likely to go to from here?
Well, it's the same thing I've been saying for the last several months, and that is that the bond market and the longer-term cycles in the bond market are showing that the bonds, could on balance head higher into the first quarter of next year, which would mean, since interest rates are inverse to the actual bonds, that could mean we'd see lower interest rates into that time frame, into the first quarter of next year. But that's a very decisive and very synergistic cycle. When it wouldn't surprise me at all to see this rate cutting cycle end. And of course, the actual Fed rate cuts could stop months before that or months after that. It's when the markets anticipate the end of that cycle that you'll see bonds top, even if the Fed doesn't make their moves right in sync with that. The markets are always leading the actual fundamental events. So that's two things to watch, but they both show that the first quarter of next year would be the ideal time for interest rates to kind of bottom out and start ticking up from there. That could be showing a combination of things where inflation's concerned, where even the dollar's concerned, but that's separate analysis.
The U.S. dollar looks like it could be putting in a double bottom, or could it go lower?
I think that before the year is up, it will definitely go lower based on my analysis. But I also do believe this is a B wave bottom of an ABC upside correction. And to put that in layman's term for anyone, any listeners that aren't familiar with Elliott Wave, our primary trend for the year has been down, so any rebound is an upside correction of that overall downtrend, and often those corrections will evolve in three waves: an initial bounce, then a new sell-off that needs to bottom out either at or above the previous low, and then a second rally, which is the C wave of that ABC formation. So I do think that's where we're at with the dollar. It has just retested its early July low, and I think we will rebound from there. There is a specific week coming in October that I've been focused on in my weekly relay publication for several weeks now, and it is when a combination of daily and weekly cycles are already converging, and that's when I think we could see the dollar rebound peak and the corresponding euro and yen sell-offs bottom out.
The Canadian dollar has been trading sideways. What do the cycles tell us about that? Is it looking bullish or bearish?
Well, I go back more to price action where the Canadian dollar is concerned. And I know I mentioned this in a couple of our discussions more recently, was that the Canadian dollar, when it signaled a multi-month peak in mid-June, it was also completing a pretty clear five-wave advance from its early February low. And when you see that, often a market will retrace to what is called the fourth wave of lesser degree. So if we had a five-wave advance, that final advance, the final rally from early May into mid-June was the fifth wave. The early May low was the fourth wave low. That is what is considered the fourth wave of lesser degree. You could just as easily call it the low before the final high. And a market will often retrace to that level. And conversely, or two sides of the same coin, that is critical support for any correction. And that was why I said that the Canadian dollar needed to go back towards 72 and that it should find pretty solid support there. We finally saw it spike down very near there in late August and really fulfill a textbook Elliott wave formation. But we are in that process of trying to bottom after seeing that low. It hasn't done enough yet to confirm a 1 to 2 month or longer bottom. There's some key technical indicators that turned neutral from down, but they need to turn up in order to validate that late August low. And if and when that happens, that would tell me the Canadian dollar has completed its correction and it's now ready to begin what would likely be a new five-wave advance from that low near 72. So as long as that level continues to hold, the Canadian dollar is in a very constructive pattern. And if it can trigger the confirming signals I need to see, then it would turn into a pretty positive bullish function that could take it higher into some key cycles next year.
Bitcoin peaked August 13th and has since pulled back and is now moving higher again. Could Bitcoin hit new highs in this cycle?
It certainly could. Once again, I'd say the price action and price indicators are what are my primary determinant. And Bitcoin had an initial decline from mid-July into early August. Then it went back up and retested its highs in mid-August, had a little bit deeper correction into late August, early September. But until it can close below 106,000, 107,000, Bitcoin remains in a multi-month uptrend. So that leaves open the potential for new highs. But right now, I think it's in more of a 2+ month trading range, and it wouldn't turn back into a bullish structure until I saw a daily close above at least 120,000. So it's vacillating near its highs, certainly has the potential to spike back up to them, but it's in more of a consolidative factor right now than anything else.
Gold broke out of its sideways trend and has been moving higher. Is the gold cycle getting close to a top?
Gold continues to adhere to my overall 3 to 6 month, 6 to 12 month, and multi-year outlook. And the key things in 2025 linked to all of those trends and outlooks was that gold should see a strong rally into late April, set a multi-month peak then, but then later in the third quarter, begin a new rally that should ultimately take it higher into late October, early November. So from an intra-year basis, from a multi-month basis, I think gold still has more upside. But on a short-term basis, we're seeing a few signs of some topping just below 37.50. Wouldn't surprise me to see a pullback back to at least 3,600, but that would be the real decision point there, whether we're going to see a little bit deeper correction before a final rally or whether that's where a new plateau is going to be set and help catapult gold up into those late October, early November cycle highs.
Silver's been hitting new highs, but not yet near its all-time high, $50 an ounce. Could the silver cycle still have a ways to go?
Silver has some very similar cycles to gold, but there are also times within the major trend that you see some serious divergence depending on whether gold is benefiting from any sort of geopolitical uncertainty or silver is benefiting from more of an inflationary and or economic bullish outlook. So silver definitely has more upside to go, I believe. It has some similar cycle progressions that are pointing to late October, early November for a more significant peak. But ever since early April, for all the white metals, for silver, platinum, palladium, my work has shown that that was the beginning of what would likely be a year-long uptrend. Doesn't mean that it goes straight up, but it means that the lowest point of that uptrend is set in early April of 2025, and the highest point of that trend is likely to be set in April or May of next year. In between, you can get very wild gyrations, but on balance, that uptrend, I expect it to last into April, May of next year.
Platinum and palladium both peaked in July, pulled back, and have been moving higher. Does it look like platinum and palladium cycles have peaked, or could they be heading for new highs?
Well, once again, you've got the corresponding price trends and outlooks and wave targets that really helped pinpoint the initial highs in platinum and palladium. When they generated those multi-month buy signals in early April at the same time as silver, I was describing some initial multi-month upside targets. In platinum, that was near 1,500. In palladium, that was up near that was right at like 1350 to 1400. And late July was when I thought we would see an initial high in those markets. They fulfilled both of those price and timing objectives, then saw some pretty serious corrections. Palladium was expected to drop back to 1100 and should find solid support there, which it did. Platinum moved pretty similarly. And so you've got two markets that fulfilled their initial upside targets, fulfilled corrective wave objectives, a little bit like when we were just talking about the Canadian dollar. And now they are trying to confirm those late August lows and signal the onset of new waves higher. So I think that ultimately platinum and palladium do have higher highs in them, and they have related cycles out in 2026, although they do diverge a bit from where I was describing for silver. So each one of them have some corresponding cycles, but also some independent ones that reflect their own governing fundamentals and cycles. But all that to say, yes, I do think that those white metals will see higher highs in the coming months.
Crude oil has been pulling back since June. Is the crude cycle looking bullish or bearish?
Crude oil has really been as much of a sideways trading market as anything over the last couple months, really since that late June sell-off. It has never closed below the late June lows. So it really has just been trading sideways for over 2 months. My work is showing that we could see all of the energy markets see a little bit of a rally at the into the end of the month, the end of September. And that will be the real key of where we get to in late September, early October, and how we get there as far as the technical structure leading into that. If crude does not exceed $68, $69 on that rally, it would be in a more bearish structure moving forward from there in the fourth quarter of 2025. So it's kind of in limbo right now, but I do think particularly what I'm seeing on the unleaded gas chart that there's very likely to see a bit more upside between now, September 20, into September 26th, 29th, and that will be when I really start to look for more clarifying signals for the trends heading into the fourth quarter.
Natural gas topped in March. Does it look like natural gas put in a bottom in August?
It does look like natural gas bottomed in the last month. It had an initial rally that turned some short-term trends bullish, which is what I like to see for initial corroboration of a low like that. It traced out what I call a 21 MAC sequence, a bullish 21 MAC sequence, and it is going through the final stages of that. If the December natural gas contract can hold around 378 to 380 as support, it could spike down there in the next couple days. But by the time we hit the September 19th weekly close, I think that it should have put in a secondary low. Then I do think we could see natural gas start to mount a little bit more substantial rally leading into late September and then into October.
What are the agriculture cycles looking like?
Actually, soybeans, corn, and wheat, the primary grain markets that I follow, are all showing signs of bottoming on a multi-month basis based on some critical technical indicators I use. The cycles are also constructive at this time, and I could see them start to mount a little bit more significant of a rally in the coming weeks and months. Wheat has really reached some extreme downside support target cycles. And so that really could be putting in a significant bottom. That doesn't mean that it automatically goes into a raging bull market, but it means that low, if and when it's confirmed, should hold for a pretty long time based on the cycles that are converging at this time. So I'm watching the grain markets. Now, some of the livestock markets are showing more signs of topping than bottoming. Some of the soft markets are really mixed. So when you get into your ag complex, it's very diverse, but I would say the grain markets are looking more constructive.
Eric, where are we in the world war and violence cycle?
We are actually into the culmination of a couple of the cycles that I've talked about with you, heck, over the last decade, really. I remember many times in the late 2010s when you might have referred to couple of the events going on, some of the saber rattling out of North Korea and other hot spots around the globe, and asking about my war cycles. And every time my response was the same, that the major war cycles that I saw, an 80-year cycle that has been so consistent for since the inception of the U.S., but even when you take a broader global perspective, I trace them back for 700 years, and that 80-year cycle had been so consistent timing major wars, and that was not coming back into play until late 2021 through late 2025. So that's what my response kept being to you was look at late 2021, early 2022 as the time when you'd see more significant warlike events and conflicts kick in. And sure enough, in late 2021, Russia started mounting troops on the Ukraine border, and early 2022, the opening salvo began, the starting pistol was fired, and those war cycles have intensified ever since. You had the Middle East kick in right in the middle of that four-year time frame from late 2021 to late 2025. It was late 2023 when the Hamas attacks on Israel took place and triggered everything going on there. But all along, I've also said that I thought late 2025 was when we would see the culmination of that war cycle. Now, you know, you can go back 80 years ago and you can see that the culmination is a time for both extremes. It's often some of the fiercest battles, most extreme events, and also the onset of peace or some form of cease firing and stopping of cessation of the battles. So we're definitely into that time frame, but like I said, that can be a very volatile time where both extremes are seen. And that, if it unfolds even close to what I expect, would usher in a related 40 and 80 year cycle that could have some even more intriguing ramifications. And that cycle, I've talked about it in my Inside Track monthly newsletter now for a couple years, but starting to elaborate more on it, begins in late 2025, goes through late 2029, and could have a real significant impact on the geopolitical structure and alliances.
Eric, where can our listeners subscribe to Inside Track with Two Eyes?
They can go to our primary website at InsideTrackTrading.com. That is INSIIDE, TrackTrading.com with the two I's in the middle of the word inside.
My guest has been Eric Haddock, CEO and President of InsideTrackTrading.com. Coming up, Robert Campbell next on This Week in Money.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Robert Campbell, publisher of the Campbell Real Estate Timing Letter. His website, realestatetiming.com. He's speaking to us from San Diego. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Thank you for having me back, Jim.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Campbell Real Estate Timing Letter and where our people can subscribe to it?
Yeah, my timing letter was born 23 years ago, and it was a product of a book that I wrote, Timing the Real Estate Market, that I self-published and sold 31,000 copies from a website. So everybody was so taken by the book that, you know, I could see initially, so I started writing a timing letter about it, you know, following, you know, six major cities in California and 17 major cities in the United States, using the the data that I showed in my timing letter how to track trends, and I've been doing that for 23 years.
Based on your book, Timing the Real Estate Market, what does the future of real estate look like?
Well, if you look back in history, which most people don't do, but they should do, there's often very identifiable patterns. And that's particularly true in real estate. And if you go back, to the 1970s, you know, over like 55 years ago, 55 years of home price movement in the United States, you'll see very identifiable patterns. When this happens, this happens. When it gets here, prices go up. When it gets here, prices go down. And where we are right now is one of those highly elevated places where prices are going to go down. Now, of course, there's no guarantees, but during the last 50 years, every time they've reached these levels, 5 out of 5 times, prices have declined, and sometimes declined significantly. Like the last time we had a price, this bubble is bigger than the last bubble. In 2006, when the bubble burst and started coming down, which my indicators identified, the peak, housing prices in the United States fell 35%. During this coming down cycle and the completion of this full cycle, I expect home prices in the United States to do the same. And that's just not a guess. That's just looking back in time and looking at history and goes, wow, look at that. This, and this. So you have to respect repeating cycles, and I do.
Gold continues to set new record highs. Do you think gold's momentum can continue?
Yes, I do. I think gold's going to go to levels that most people are not going to believe, and it's because we're in a whole different world right now. That gold isn't an inflation hedge. That you know, over the course of the last, like, let's say, going back 50 years in U.S. real estate, and compare that to how well it's performed against gold, the price of gold, they're neck and neck. Real estate's done a little better, but not much. So it is a good long-term investment. But what's happening now, gold is reacting to geopolitical problems. And another big thing is that the world isn't the safe place it used to be. You know, there's wars breaking out everywhere, big wars. The U.S. is $37 trillion in debt. The world's in huge debt. And we've been living on borrowed money for a long time. And then at some point, it reaches the point where it's unsustainable. And I've heard that before, but that's what gold's reacting to right now. People would rather be in a tangible, physical asset like gold or even real estate as opposed to a financial asset, you know, like stocks or bonds. The thing about real estate, however, even though it's a tangible asset, the fact that we're at this point in the cycle, just like at the last turning point in the cycle of 2006, real estate is super overpriced. And so most likely it's going to go down significantly, you know, regardless of what gold does. So gold is the preferred investment, I think, for at least the next 5 years.
Historically, how many ounces of gold does it take to buy an average house?
Well, that varies. That changes over time. Let me go back to the last cycle. In 2006, it took, I think it was 468 ounces of gold to buy the average priced house in the United States. 468. At the bottom of the cycle in 2012, it took less than half that number of ounces. I think that's what the number should. Let me reach. That's not here. Where is that? Let me see if I can recheck that just to be 100% sure for our followers. I have that right in front of me. It's really important, guys. This is important stuff. Let's see. At the peak in 2006, gold was $550 an ounce, and you can buy a U.S. home with 645 ounces. At the 2012 bottom, 6 years later, gold had risen to $1,435 an ounce, and you could buy the same home with 159 ounces of gold. In other words, that 1 ounce of gold bought four times as much house. And that's what I expect to happen this time too. Right now, I think the median price at the peak of the market in 2022, when real houses peaked, you could buy a I think you could buy a home, the average price home for as expensive as it is, for 268 ounces of gold. Fast forward 3 years to today, that same average price home only costs you could be had for 160 ounces of gold. So during the last 3 years, the price of housing in the U.S. has gone up 10%. It's still rising. It hasn't fallen yet, but the price of gold has doubled. So you ask yourself, why has gold performed like that? I mean, I have my own ideas. Nobody ever knows really why something's happening. All you can do is open your eyes and watch what is happening and respect that, which I do.
Do you think home prices and gold can continue to move higher together?
Not likely. It's very unlikely that housing prices are going to move higher from current levels for the simple reason that, again, if you go back in time, that when you look at when housing prices get real expensive, like they are now, like they were in 2006, and like they were in previous peaks of cycles, housing becomes unaffordable. People can't afford a house. So when people can't afford a house, they don't buy. They can't buy, or they don't want to buy, which is the case right now. So all of a sudden the trend turns, and the cycle turns from one of greed driven to one of fear driven, and prices revert back to a mean where houses are not only cheap, but they're highly affordable again, and that turns the cycle up, and that's the start of the new bull market.
Around May of 2022, we hit peak house prices. We're more than 3 years out of that. Are we getting close to where home prices could dive lower?
Absolutely. We're in very thin air right now. Very thin air. Housing affordability is still at or near record lows. We're in what I call the danger zone, where that affordability gets to these levels. If you study how affordability goes up and down over time, when it gets to these levels, which affordability is real low, prices go down. All of a sudden, when housing affordability gets really high, it goes up. But most people don't watch that metric. But I do, because it's very telling. It's not a precise timing indicator, but it tells you that. It gives you a really good idea when you should be entering the market to buy low and when you should be exiting the market to sell high.
The U.S. has a $37 trillion plus debt. Does President Trump have thoughts or plans to turn the U.S. dollar-denominated debt into crypto debt?
Yeah, I've been reading a little bit about that, and I'm not very qualified to comment about it. However, I see, knowing what I know about economics and about debt, and the U.S. Debt to income, debt to GDP ratio is at 120%, which historically means a collapse of the economy. I think that's a desperate move to somehow convert the people that own the debt, the treasury securities, into crypto securities. And then find a way to crash the market so that the holders of those debt securities kind of get screwed, but the U.S. doesn't have to admit that they defaulted on their debt. That I could be off on that, but it's something to that effect, because otherwise it makes no sense to me why you would want to do that.
This week, the Fed cut rates by a quarter point. The Bank of Canada dropped its rate by a quarter of a percent. Can interest rates that are kept artificially low cause problems in the economy?
Yeah. I mean, the stock market is at record highs right now. U.S. stock market, record highs. And the Fed's cutting interest rates? You know who's bread they're buttering? It's the rich people that own stocks, for sure. There's no reason to cut rates. I mean, yeah, unemployment has climbed modestly, very modestly. But this is totally a political move. And in my view, it's a political move by the by Trump and his administration to artificially force interest rates lower, because $11 trillion of that treasury debt, of that $37 trillion in treasury debt, needs to be refinanced, I believe, in the next 12 months. And would you rather refinance it at a lower interest rate or a higher interest rate? Lower, of course. Right now, I think the debt servicing on that, on the U.S. national debt is like $1.2 trillion a year. $1.2 trillion. The U.S. only spends $850 billion on defense. So that's the elephant in the room. If rates were to keep going up, and all of a sudden, you know, they need to refinance that debt at a higher interest rate or more debt at an interest rate, we're putting $2 to $3 trillion a year added to the national debt. Pretty soon that debt servicing is going to go to 1.5, then 1.8, then $2 trillion a year. It's going to overwhelm the U.S. economy. Pretty soon they're going to start, and this just makes sense. Pretty soon they're going to have to start printing money, if they're not doing it already, just to cover debt servicing. That's the desperation what I see right now, and why Trump and other people in this administration are considering, you know, converting the debt to crypto, and that'll somehow save us, because the amount of debt we're putting on the books and the interest we're paying on that debt is eating us alive.
China, Russia, the BRICS have been and continue to load up on gold. Is this likely a sign of strength for gold or a warning sign of a top ahead?
Nope. And this isn't anything recent they've been doing that. China's been buying, you know, a significant amount of gold for the last 10 years. Russia's been buying a significant amount of gold going back 10 years. India likes gold anyway. They've been buying more gold. I think that and those are all BRIC countries. I think they see the writing on the wall, and they're unloading U.S. net, they're getting rid of U.S. Treasury debt, and they're buying more gold. And they're forming an alliance, a BRIC alliance, a trading alliance with each other in order to do business with themselves so they don't need the U.S. dollar in order to facilitate their trade. I think they saw this coming 10 years ago, and I don't know what their ultimate plan is, whether they're going to take one of their currencies, you know, the yuan or the ruble or whatever, and start making it and backing it by gold. But there's a reason these countries own a lot of gold. Contrary to popular opinion, China and Russia are not stupid. They wouldn't be doing this for no reason. And so there's a reason there, and I think that we're starting to see the reason right now, that the debt is getting so high, not only globally, but in the United States, and we have the world reserve currency. They're going, this can't last much longer. And so we've got gold. If we have to protect, you know, revalue gold to protect our own currencies and stay within the BRICS and stabilize and have, you know, stable and growing trade among us, we may have to revalue gold and make it part of our system. So that's very, very important. These guys have a lot of gold.
Could President Trump legally revalue gold to back the U.S. currency?
Yep, he can with one signature. Well, I don't know about backing. I think he can. I know he can. He can revalue gold. That he alone can do that. Now, whether he can do that to back the currency, I'm not sure of that. So if tomorrow we woke up and all of a sudden it was breaking news on the financial news network that, you know, the President of the United States has revalued gold to $40,000 an ounce, would that be something that could be challenged? No. You can revalue your gold anything you want, just like the U.S. government did in the 1930s. I think in 1931, gold was $20 an ounce, and President Franklin Roosevelt revalued it to 35, just like that. Boom. This time's going to make a much bigger revaluation.
How could the U.S., one country, change the price of gold, which is set by an international market?
Because everybody would be paying that much for it. Now, all of a sudden, they did it in the 1930s. It's been international all the time. They did it in the 1930s. You can say it's worth whatever you want to say it's worth. And all of a sudden, if it's worth for, and who owns the gold? central banks, countries. Does little John Q. Public own a lot of gold? No, he doesn't. Rich people own gold. So if he says that he's going to revalue gold to $40,000 an ounce, let's say, and he goes, why? Because we're backing our $37 trillion worth of debt with 20% gold, 30% gold, or whatever number he wants to use relative to the revaluation. He can do that. He can do that. If he says gold's worth $40,000 an ounce, nobody's going to trade it for $3,700 where it's at right now. Ain't going to happen. Nope. Because that's a windfall for the owners of gold. A windfall. And now you can save the system. Now you can save the debt system in the United States, which is five times greater than the equity market. So the debt has to be saved one way or another. Either you convert it into crypto and crash the crypto market, or you revalue gold and back it with, 20, 30, 40% gold, whatever you prefer.
Could revaluing the gold price save the U.S. and its system of governance?
Yeah, sure. Now all of a sudden you trust that, I mean, save. That's a very subjective word, what you mean by save. There's a lot of problems with the U.S. right now, and it's just not the amount of debt. But you could save the financial system. The bond market wouldn't collapse. See, because all of a sudden you start to see the U.S. is piling on $3 trillion a year on average on the debt market, and even if interest rates stay the same, pretty soon you're going to be at $1.5 trillion with a debt servicing, then $2 trillion with a debt servicing. And all of a sudden, pretty soon, you keep doing that. Now nobody wants to buy U.S. Treasury debt, Treasury debt at all, at 5%. So to sell it to somebody, what interest rate you going to put it at? I don't know, 10? 10? Okay, now people are willing to buy all this debt that you're selling so you can live above your means, right? Right. So what is 10? I mean, I'm just using that as a hypothetical number, double what it is now. Coupon on a 30-year treasury note do to debt servicing? It would double it. So instead of being at $1.5 trillion, now that we're $3 trillion. If you remember during the inflationary times of the late 1970s and early 1980s, 30-year treasury bonds were selling at 15%. Inflation was at 13%. And for anybody to buy a U.S. Treasury bond, which is considered one of the most safest investments in the world, guaranteed to get your money back, even though you don't know what that money back is going to pay for, I think it got up to 15%. If that happened today, the whole economy would collapse. You know, like one half or more of all tax revenues would have to pay for debt servicing. So it's all math, guys. Just do the math. You know, things that are unsustainable can't be, that don't continue over time. You just can't keep piling on debt after debt after debt, and all of a sudden nobody trusts your system anymore, because they know inflation's more than 3% with the government's reporting. And all of a sudden they go, you want to buy that debt for at 5%? No. How about 6? No. 7? No. Give me 8. Okay. Next year it's 10. Because that's what it's going to take to offset the risk. And pretty soon that, you know, you have debt servicing with a growing national debt at $2 to $3 trillion a year. You know, anywhere from $3 trillion a year just to service the debt. See, that's when everything comes apart. That's when everything. One thing that I've learned, you know, my background's economics. I have a degree in economics from UCLA. It's nothing lasts forever. Nothing. That countries don't last forever. Economic systems don't last forever. And if you just keep going deeper and deeper into debt, pretty soon it's going to backfire on you, and all of a sudden your debt's no good. And what do you do? Print money like they did the Weimar Republic? Just start printing money and dropping it into people's hands? Then the currency's worth nothing. Then the whole thing collapses. You know, this is that. This isn't something new, guys. Go back in history and look at how many countries have inflated their currencies tremendously. That if you go back the last, like, maybe 50 years in the world, even though this isn't publicized, I think there's been like 50 hyperinflations in the world. 50. Where the currency becomes worthless. So the United States isn't immune, you know, from that kind of event. Not at all. And in fact, that may be the direction we're heading. Unless somebody does something, prudent to get the government to live within its means and may revalue gold, and they're going to have to do a whole lot of things. But it's historical. It happens.
Is the U.S. dollar close to losing reserve status?
Well, that I don't know. I mean, would a loss of reserve status be something that is unprecedented? No. You go back and look at the currency that was a reserve currency, over the last, 300 years. I think there's five different countries. The last was England. Then they blew it. So then they went to the United States after World War II because we were the least affected by the war and in the best position to profit from, cleaning up the damage. So could it? I mean, but that's the whole thing why the BRICS came together. They don't want to depend on the U.S. dollar. They're trading in yuan or rubles. They don't need the U.S. dollar. And that's one of the reasons that Trump and the U.S. government is panicking. They ordered India, a sovereign country, with what, 1.5 billion people, said, you better disassociate yourself from BRICS, or something bad's going to happen to you. Now it's coming down to threats. But the BRIC countries are a clear and present danger to a financial system that's been relying on the U.S. dollar since after World War II.
Canada and the U.S. have debt-to-GDP ratios significantly in excess of 100%. Could turning this debt into cryptocurrencies allow the countries to start over?
I have no idea. I don't understand cryptocurrencies, so I'm not the person you should be talking to about cryptocurrencies. I go back in time. To me, would I invest in cryptocurrencies? No, I would not. And I consider myself to be a pretty good investor. I've done, better than your average bear in the markets over time. Thank you, God. But so would I invest in cryptos? No, I don't know what backs them. To me, it's just like, it's a digital asset. What does that mean? Digital asset. So I'm just afraid of it. So, I stick with things that have been true for thousands of years, particularly like gold, real estate, things like that, and play the cycles.
Bringing manufacturing back to the U.S. would involve higher labor costs. Would that be good or bad for the economy?
That would be bad for the economy. I know Trump, wants to bring manufacturing back in the United States. Well, we've outsourced manufacturing, for the last, four decades to China, to India, to Vietnam, and other, low labor force economies. And all of that's why the stock market's so high. These companies are manufacturing things in China, let's say, where they pay people like one-tenth of what they pay them in the United States. They import them in the United States and sell them for a high, very profitable. If those same goods were manufactured in the United States, would the big corporations have those same profit margins? Absolutely not. Nothing. They would have to jack the price up, way up, in order to make the same the kind of profit margins they're making right now. So how does that affect the U.S. tax? How does that affect the U.S. economy? That with high-priced goods, it's going to be very, very destructive to the economy because people can't afford that. They can't afford it. They can't afford, to, bring manufacturing into the United States. Let's say you can produce a widget for $10 in China, that's manufactured in China, and you bring it in the United States, and it costs $15. People can't afford those widgets. And if you don't think that China has a huge hold on the U.S. economy, go down in Home Depot and start looking at everything Home Depot sells, from power tools, you know, to glue, to, you know, other things, right down the list. And look and see where they're manufactured. 80 to 90% of that stuff's manufactured in China. So all of a sudden, we're gonna manufacture, bring it all back to the United States, pay our workers, you know what, $20, $25 an hour to produce it, instead of $2 to $5 an hour. That power tool that, you know, that you can, that skill saw you can buy right now for $150, it's gonna cost you $350. And incomes aren't going to double or triple. That ain't going to happen. So it would be devastating to the economy to do that. See, we've let this go on for way too long. It started small, then it's growing. So now all of a sudden you want to reverse course and make everything in the United States, and it's going to be super expensive. Why do you think U.S. weapons are so expensive, Jim? They're manufactured in the United States. They're not manufactured in China or Russia. They can build the same weapon system for half the price, and they're twice as good, as evidenced by what this F-35 costs. We're a very expensive place to make stuff, and that's why it's been outsourced. So all of a sudden, to think we're going to reverse this, and, you know, all of a sudden, you know, the guys that are making, you know, $15 an hour right now, or $10 an hour, or $20 an hour, whatever, in the United States, and all of a sudden, they get into a manufacturing job, and they're going to make $25. That's not going to offset the cost of the good they have to buy. It's not even going to come close. So I don't understand this, you know, what Trump's trying to do with these tariffs and all this kind of stuff. You know, it's nothing that I've ever studied and looked into, and I doubt it's going to be successful.
Rich versus poor, is the divide growing?
Absolutely, it's divided growing. I just read a statistic the other day that 1% of the richest Americans in the United States own 50% of the assets. 50%. And the bottom 50%, the 50% of all Americans that are the poorest, they own 1% of the assets. One. There's your answer right there why everybody in the United States is pissed off. It is. That's ridiculous. You know, the rich have everything. They control everything. You know, they buy and sell the politicians, you know, to get favorable treatment all along the line, you know, to restrict goods, you know, lower priced goods from coming to the United States, and the stocks keep going up, which they own the majority of, and they just keep getting richer and richer, and the poor keep getting poorer and poorer. That's not the way that you build longevity for a country, guys. So, I mean, that, you know, I've been blessed that I'm a baby boomer, okay? It's gotten immeasurably worse, you know, in the last 50, 60 years. And I've been fortunate, you know, that, you know, after that, when I grew up, to be able to make money, and have done so. By the time I grew up in a little beach community in California, in San Diego, named Encinitas. Encinitas, okay? By the time I was 30 years old, I was always motivated to make money. I owned 13 rental properties in Encinitas. 13! I owned 5 myself, and I brought in 5 partners where I split the money with. Today, you couldn't even buy, somebody like myself, I would be hard-pressed to even buy one. Things are so expensive, so the opportunity for gain is way, way lower. If I was growing up, if I was getting out of college today and wanted to make money in real estate, which is my background, which I'm, you know, best suited for, I wouldn't do it in California. I'd move to someplace like Detroit or in the Midwest. you know, and I'm sure I'd make a lot of money, knowing what I know, but it's not going to be from, you know, San Diego County, where the average price house cost $1 million. No. So I'd have to get away. But things have really, really changed.
What's the latest on real estate across the U.S.?
It's still going up in value. The price appreciation on a year-to-year basis has been declining for the last 12 straight months. 12 straight months. So like 12 months ago, that U.S. real estate was appreciating at probably 5 or 6%. Today, it's appreciating by 1.5%. And it's the same in California. Prices are still going up. Even though sales are down 40%, building permits are way down. And those that, you know, home sales and building permits, the reason I mention that is that I identified those two key indicators as being highly correlated with price movement. So if sales are down 40%, building permits are down, down 10 to 15%, how come prices are still rising? Because there's no supply. Nobody's selling. Very few, but that's changing too. That you can see that trend. You know, like a year ago, there was like, there was only something like, you know, 2.5 or 2 months of available supply of homes for sale at the prevailing sales rate. Today, that's up to 4.5%. So historically, if you look at the trends and look at the correlations, that housing prices are highly correlated with the inventory on the market. Until it gets over 6%, which could be, you know, it could be soon, it could take 6 months, that housing prices are going to continue to go up. Would I buy at these levels? Never. I'd be selling into these levels. Because we're hugely in the danger zone. Huge. I mean, if you fast forward 5 years and you said, what's the chance of losing money versus making money in real estate during the next 5 years? And I'm talking about on a real basis, God. I'm not talking about some highly inflated number where inflation's 10%, you know, so housing goes up, you know, 7%, where you're still losing money. I would say the odds in the next 5 years that housing prices will be higher on an inflation-adjusted basis are like 0 to 5%.
What's the latest on California real estate?
Same thing. Low supply. You know, in California, the median price home, in this whole state of California, the median price home is $900,000 to $1 million. Now, not every place in California is a beach community like it is in San Diego. It's not. You have the Central Valley where there's farmers out there, you know, that, you know, Modesto was agriculture. Prices are much lower out there, much lower. But prices are still increasing, and they're increasing for the simple fact that it's even though demand is down 40% in California, supply is down more. So, you know, until they get at equilibrium, you're not going to see a price change. It doesn't matter. If demand falls by 50% and supply falls by 75%, are prices going to go up? Yeah. Because there's more demand than supply. And until that trend reverses, then you'll see the correction that I anticipate where, you know, California, U.S. housing prices, California is going to fall 5 or 10% more than U.S. The U.S. is going to fall 35, California between 40 and 45. And that's when you buy.
With all that's going on in the world today, how important is it not to ignore your mental health?
You can't ever ignore that, guys. In my last, that mental and physical health. Look, I like making money as much as the next guy and probably more. But the first thing I do when I get up in the morning is I ask myself, what am I going to do today for my physical health? Am I going to go to the gym? Am I going to go run up hills? Am I going to go take a 6 mile walk in the canyons with my beagles, which is super exhausting? What am I going to do? I don't wake up in the morning and go, gee, but where am I going to find a real estate deal where I can make another 50 grand? No, that's not the first thing I think about. It's not the first thing I think about. And that I have to tell you a story I became a friend with a retired medical doctor. His practice was in Del Mar, California, which is a very affluent area. Bill Gates owns a house on the beach there that's worth $100 million. That's high-priced stuff, right on the sand. Well, we started going to the same gym together, and one day we became friends. He saw me running on the beach from like age 45 to age 60. I ran 4 miles every other day in the soft sand barefoot. And he lived close to the beach, so he was down there too. He used to go swimming. And we used to say hi, wave at each other. 15 years. Then we went to the same gym, and he saw how I worked out with weights. He took me aside one day and said, "Mr. Campbell, I had a very successful practice in Del Mar, California. Those people are older and in poor health, but they have a lot of money." He looked at me and said, "Do you know how much of their money they would give to be as healthy as you?" And I was like 74 years old at the time. I just looked at him and said, "All of it." And it's true, guys. You just can't say, "I'm going to start tomorrow. I'm going to, you know, I don't have time to work on my physical health right now. You know, I got more important things to do. I need to make a lot of money." I guarantee you, if you make a lot of money and your health is crap, it doesn't matter. You have a crap life. You have to take care of your health. And I do every single day. So, that's the message I give to my followers. And that's the message I get to the listeners today. Don't put it off. If you put off taking care of your health until you're after 60 years old, you have a hard road, to follow, guys. Cause, you know, all of a sudden you're in terrible shape. You know, you're overweight. 40% of all Americans are obese. 40%! So you're one of those 40%, you're obese. And say, "I'm going to do what Robert Campbell says, you know, I want to look like him. You know, I'm going to go to the gym and start working out." Do you know how long it's going to take to get in shape when you're in the kind of physical condition I am? I mean, you know, am I like super muscular? No, but I'm not fat and I'm strong. You know how long it's going to take? It's going to take 3 years. 3 years. How many of those people are going to get impatient before that 3-year period and stop and just live a miserable, unhealthy life thereafter? Practically all of them. So you have to start early. I started when I was 48 years old. 48 years old. I got a divorce, from the wife of and mother of my 2 kids, and I wanted to attract another really hot babe into my life. So I joined a gym. I hadn't joined a gym before that forever. And I was still in good shape. I used to run 4 miles a day, you know, in the soft sand or on the street. I did push-ups, I did sit-ups, and I played sports. I was in a great shape. I wanted to be in better shape because I wanted to attract a really hot woman into my life. And I did. And I've had an annual gym for 30 years. So when you get older, guys, if you're not physically active in sports or doing running, things like that, you have to join a gym. That's what's going to motivate you. I mean, even as motivated as I am, I'm not going to work out in my garage. I'll find 10 reasons, you know, not to do it. But when I go to the gym and see my homies and my friends, you know, that working out and lifting weights and getting strong and looking good, guess what? I'm going to do that too.
Robert, where can people follow you and buy your book, Timing the Real Estate Market, and subscribe to your newsletter?
They can go to realestatetiming.com, realestatetiming.com. And I know the last time we talked, I encouraged a lot of people there to go to sign up. I do a blog post about once every 2 weeks or so, and a lot of people really enjoy them. Even if you don't get my timing letter, you know, right now, or want to read my book on how to make better real estate decisions as far as buying when it's cheap and selling when it's low, sign up for my blog. I think you're going to find that interesting from a lot of reasons. You're probably going to make a lot more money in real estate. But I talk about things like health. I still focus on health, guys. I don't need any more money at this point in my life. You know, I'm not the richest guy in the world, but I'm sure as hell not the poorest guy. And that's good. So every day it's health, 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 health. And that's why I'm able to, you know, to live such a good, good, good life. You know, I've stayed healthy. I don't take any meds. I've never had any artificial, you know, joints put in my system, you know. I encourage you, aside from making money, get healthy, guys. And if you want mental health, which Jim Fisher referred to, you got to be physically healthy. You're not going to be mentally strong and really sharp if you're obese. It ain't going to happen. Nope, it's not going to happen. Sorry. But all of a sudden, you're in good shape, you're thin, you're strong. And you know what? And that goes over to your mental attitude. You feel good about yourself. You make better decisions. And people can see it, guys. Once you put yourself in that place, believe me, other people notice. One, they're not like it, but just do it for yourself. It makes you more confident in dealing with anything in life you want to do. Anything. I mean, you'll make better decisions. You'll think better. So, health first, guys.
Thank you again, Robert. My guest has been Robert Campbell, publisher of the Campbell Real Estate Timing Letter, his website, realestatetiming.com. He was speaking to us from San Diego. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Eric Haddock, and Robert Campbell. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or for our guests, you can send them to info@housetreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.